This is Ryan Dawson of the ANC Report. Before I kick things off with Mr. David Cole Stein, I'd like to direct everybody over to his YouTube page to get a little extra on this topic about the mobile gas vans. This is something that was a video which was played in the Museum of Tolerance, which is absolutely a Holocaust museum, but they didn't want to label it like that because they wanted to get the city to pay for it. And it purports to be a documentary of these mobile gassings where the Nazis went around in gas vans and picked up Jewish children and threw them in the back and gassed them and then dumped the bodies, which is awful. But the reality is it was from a fictional Polish film. They took the credits off and the sound off and acted like it was a documentary, completely fake. That's something you can't make a mistake about. That has to be intentional, because they would have to go find the film and edit the film and then lie and say it was an authentic film. Why would you do that if you have plenty of real material that you can use? Anyway, Mr. David Cole Stein has footage of both films. You can see them side by side. He completely busted that one open over. So after this talk, kick over to his YouTube page and check out that footage and his commentary. I'm going to do my little CNN / Fox News intro first, and then I'll do a real introduction, but I think you'll think this is funny.
I'm looking forward to it.
Joining us today is the self-hating Jew and neo-Nazi who kicks puppies and said your mother was bad in bed. He stated that he was happy that Fox canceled Firefly and he steals candy from babies. Mr. David Cole, what do you do when you're not taping porno inside of children's books at the store or throwing darts at pictures of baby Jesus?
Well, the thing is, I really didn't like Firefly. You actually hit the nail on the head with that one. The other stuff I'm not sure about. But the Firefly thing, it's one of those fan-based shows that I never could get into. So, yeah, that one I plead guilty to, 100%.
See, you just lost two listeners.
one of my friends from the Hollywood Republican group that I helped run for 5 years is an actor named Adam Baldwin, who was, I believe he was on Firefly. He's the big, he's like a tall guy, broad-shouldered. He's not one of the Baldwins. He's not a Baldwin. He's the Baldwin who was around before there were Baldwins. And I believe he was one of the, I think he was one of the leads on Firefly.
I only saw like a few shows. But it was people are very passionate about. And I can say all this stuff about Rupert Murdoch and his relationship with Boris Berezovsky and criminal things, and then doesn't matter. And I go, and he canceled Firefly. And they go, oh, what an asshole.
that'll happen with me as well, Ryan. I can say things when I'm on Facebook or online, and I can talk about politics, history, or anything. But occasionally, especially if I'm interacting with somebody from the UK, they'll mention, oh, you must have loved The Prisoner. And I'll say, I've never seen The Prisoner. Well, you must have loved Doctor Who. I've never seen Doctor Who. Well, which Doctor didn't you see? No, I haven't seen any Doctor Who's. None of them. I think one of them was Tom Baker and the other one was Eccleston. Something Eccleston, but I've never seen a Doctor Who. I've never seen The Prisoner, but I was a huge fan of the Avengers during the Emma Peel years, and that just alienates the UK people more, because they're like, you liked the Avengers, but not The Prisoner. The Prisoner was brilliant. So yeah, that's a very good point that you raise, Ryan.
Well, people get really, really attached to film and things like that, and it's weird what sticks. I mean, if you remember the story where and there was a video of it. I think it was in Iraq or Afghanistan. I think it was Iraq. There was a soldier who threw a puppy off a cliff, which is horrible.
Yeah.
And people lost their minds. But I thought, there's 500,000 children who've starved to death. Why aren't you losing your mind over that? But the puppy, that's what did it. Or the guys that peed on the dead or something. I'm like, aren't you a little bit more upset that they're dead, that they were shot, than that they're getting peed on? Just as, you know.
Oh, yeah. Look, I have friends who can watch the most grotesque of footage when it has to do with humans. I plead guilty to that myself. In the course of my Holocaust research, I've seen truly, truly terrible, horrific, ghastly footage having to do with inhumanities committed upon people. I can watch that. I can look at it clinically. I can absorb it clinically. But honestly, I cannot look at videos of animals being harmed. I just can't. I can't even look at a puppy being accidentally hit with a stick during some piñata celebration at a Mexican birthday party. I can't do that. So that, I think that is a common situation with a lot of people, where there's sort of a line that's drawn with animals, and yet the abuses and inhumanities towards people are easier to take.
Sadly, I think that's because there is so much abuse towards other people that we get numb to it.
Yeah, I would certainly agree about that. I think we do get numb to it. And I think there's also the humans have an ability to rationalize. For example, if you see video of a person being killed in Iraq or Afghanistan, and people have the ability to rationalize it away by saying, well, he deserved it. He had it coming. Well, he shouldn't have been hanging out with insurgents. He shouldn't have been in that border region. He shouldn't have been there. People have that ability to wish away the things they don't want to confront. But when it comes to animals, when you can't really assign to them the kind... Exactly. So it's like, oh, that dog didn't deserve it. Of course. Oh, that dog had... How could that dog have deserved it? So... That defense mechanism so many human beings have of being able to rationalize away inhumanities towards humans, it doesn't work when it comes to animals, even with children. Like if a kid gets blown up in a drone strike, there are people say, well, his dad shouldn't have had him tagging along. His dad shouldn't have had him in that hovel. His dad shouldn't have had him in that valley. There's always that rationalization, but it typically falls short when you're dealing with a dog or a cat or one of the animals that we tend to anthropomorphize and think of as having human traits.
Well, plus it's usually brown children, and everyone knows they don't really count.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting, though, because for a lot of young people, especially people today, when we look back to World War II and to the horrific, horrific carnage, and to the terrible toll to German civilians, during that war, and how very lightly it was taken. And even to this day, there is a refusal to confront even what happened to German Americans and German immigrants in the United States and North and South and Central America during the war. We're very quick to recognize, when I say we, I mean the United States government, speaking as a U.S. citizen, the United States government is very quick to recognize, and has been since the 80s and even earlier than that, to recognize the internment of Japanese Americans and Japanese non-citizens. But one of the documentaries I was working on during my David Stein years was a documentary about the internment of German Americans and German non-citizens. It's a very interesting, untold story of the war, and there was a lot more sympathy after the war towards the Japanese Americans who had been interned, as opposed to the German Americans and the German immigrants and non-citizens who had been interned. They were in one of the most unique cases in American history. German Americans who were interned during the war were actually expatriated, sent back to Germany after the war. Now, these were people born here, born in the United States. So you can't say they were repatriated, because you can't be repatriated to a place that you never came from. German Americans, mainly children, were sent to Germany at the end of 1945, as the Truman administration was attempting to clear out the Crystal City camp, which was a camp in Texas, Crystal City, Texas, that was about 60% Japanese and about 40% German. And that's one of the most interesting stories that I would like at some point to be able to tell, if only from the point of view of what happens to human rights and civil rights during wartime, especially when no one's paying attention. You had I had followed the story.
Well,
of these
I mean, worse than that was Operation Keyhole, where they sent the Russians back to Russia
of
and
course.
They all got murdered.
Yeah. Absolutely. But even in that case, your average American might say, well, you know, that's foreigners. That's going to happen to those damn foreigners. What was really interesting about the expatriation of German Americans, most of them were kids. They were mainly from the East Coast. They were mainly from New York, New Jersey. And they found themselves all of a sudden 9 years old, 10 years old, being told, you're going back to Germany. Like, but we were born in Brooklyn. Go back to Germany. So it's one of the stories that has never really been well illustrated in film and documentary form and even in books over the years. And it one of the many things that I hope to be able to direct my attention back to now that I'm back doing this kind of thing full time.
I think there's a lot of post-war stuff and that happens to the losing side in every war, in World War II, especially the amount of starvation that happened in Germany. Or in Vietnam or in Cambodia, where they still are dealing with Agent Orange. The war hasn't ended for them, but once the war ends, it's out of sight, out of mind. And whatever's still going on, just whatever. If they lost, then they don't really matter. And there was a lot of starvation in Germany post-war. My grandfather was part of the occupied forces there, and then he got sent to the Korean War right after that. But what he said of Germany was just they would send little kids in begging for food to the U.S. kitchen there and the little base they had.
It was a horrific situation. The winter of 45 and 46, that winter was probably the worst that the German people had experienced because of the lack of food, the lack of any kind of an infrastructure in their major cities, and the Morgenthau plan that basically called for Germany to be reduced to a primitive agrarian state. And in the winter of 45-46, that plan was in full force. There are a lot of very good books that have been written, that were written mainly in the 50s, about the Morgenthau plan and the policy of what we used to call denazification, which was in a way a kind of pogrom by fear. People being disappeared in the middle of the night, people being encouraged to inform on their neighbors, you know, nothing that still doesn't go on. But we don't know a lot of those stories from the post-World War II years. There were a couple of U.S. military figures who rebelled against that. They felt that this government was alienating the German people and, in fact, just serving the Soviet goal of trying to kick the Western allies out of Germany by turning the people against them. So there were some very, very good books. A lot of them have never been put online. One of the things I learned in the process of writing my own book last year, and the copy editor I worked with, very fine woman who does this for a living at major publications, and she would ask for online references about a lot of the documents and the quotes that I use. And at least 50, 60 or 60% of them came from books that I have, books from the 40s and 50s that have never been scanned online. They're not available in any library. And so that became a challenge when she would say, well, send me a link to prove this quote from 1944. And I would say, well, really all I can do is send you the National Archive document or the book that cites the document. But a lot of the really good stuff has not been put online. People who only do their research online are missing out on something, and they're missing out on some of the really wonderful contemporaneous books that were never scanned into any online archive.
Yeah, you'll see with history online that it kind of goes in circles, and they're missing a lot of material from books. And that's the majority of history, obviously, was in the era of the paper era. But that book you're talking about is Republican Party Animals, and that's out now, right?
Well, it's available for pre-order now, and it will be mailed to people on May 13th. It's available Barnes & Noble, Walmart, Amazon for people in the UK, Foyles and Waterstones, the two biggest bookstores there, plus Amazon.uk, .co.uk, and Amazon.de, the German Amazon. Now, this is an interesting case here, Ryan, because my book is almost certainly illegal in Germany. I'm fascinated that Amazon.de is selling it, because Amazon, the German Amazon, is not allowed to sell revisionist books. I'm not sure whether it's just that nobody has caught on yet. I've gotten a couple of comments on my YouTube videos and elsewhere, people saying, huh, this book must be a sellout if it's available in all these places. And number one, the people who leave those comments haven't read the book. But when they do read the book, they will see that it's definitely not a sellout. I just think that it hasn't occurred to certain people yet to try to get Walmart and Amazon.de to not carry it. There's never been a Holocaust revisionist book carried by Walmart. It's never happened before. And I think that a lot of it was my publisher and I jointly, but him a little more because he's the one who knows the business. We realized that we had to play up the angle of my time with the Hollywood conservatives, the Hollywood Republicans. The book is 50% my revisionism and 50% the years after I fled revisionism. People will get a tremendous education about Holocaust revisionism and about the truths and falsehoods of World War II. They'll get a great education, whether they want to or not. I hope that some people read the book because they want to read about my Clint Eastwood stories and my Kelsey Grammer and my Gary Sinise stories, because those are in there and they're legitimate and they're real. But I'm hoping that people read the book for that and then come away saying, wow, I really learned all about Auschwitz and the flaws in the Final Solution theory and everything else. I think my publisher did a good job by playing up the Holocaust, Hollywood GOP angle, because it makes the book seem like
that was a
like
great
it.
Freudian slip there. The Holocaust, I mean the Hollywood.
Yes.
That literally part of what it was. They brought in Billy Wilder, who later did the Marilyn Monroe films, to do props and stuff. And I want to get into that, too. But when you said you were in it and you got out of it, I'm sure you're sick of explaining this to people, but so you can do so briefly if you want. But why did you get out of it? You were in it. You had all this work in it. What happened to you to force you out of the game?
Well, there's the passive reason and the active reason. The passive reason, the one that was not necessarily the punch in the face, figuratively or literally, but the passive reason was by 1995, I'd been in it since 89. And I had tried very, very, very hard to make my case and be heard. Now, for your younger listeners, they have to remember, they have to dial back and remember this was the pre-internet days. There was no internet. Nowadays, if anyone says, gosh, I want to be heard, well, start a website, promote your videos on YouTube, get a Facebook fan page. I mean, all of this stuff that's available now, if you go back to 1989 and 1990, well, it wasn't available then. What that meant was for someone like me, you were always at the mercy of an editor. Either a friendly editor or an unfriendly editor, but I was either carried by the Institute for Historical Review in their journal. They were friendly.
That was
Mark Weber. And they were always very kind to me. And Mark Weber's a very close friend to this day. And then the unfriendly editors at the New York Times, the New Yorker, the Jerusalem Post. Very unfriendly at the Jerusalem Post, very unfriendly at the Jerusalem Report, which was at the time Israel's biggest weekly news magazine. I don't know if the Jerusalem Report's still around or not, but they were really, really bad to me. And then TV editors, 60 Minutes, 48 Hours, all of those shows. So you are always at the mercy of someone who could mute you or edit you or cut you out of something. And that made it very hard. So by 1995, I had become somewhat convinced that I just couldn't be heard. I had been treated so poorly so many times on the network TV shows and in the print press and magazines.
That's why I did that joke intro saying you're a self-hating Jew and a neo-Nazi and stuff, because that was, I'm actually picking on those three-letter networks because they would compare you to Arafat and Saddam Hussein and Hitler David Cole. Like, what?
Yeah, there was no sense of proportionality to their attacks. I was the worst man on earth. And also part of that passive reason why I got out, a feeling of being defeated, coupled with some of the people I worked with, like a fellow named Dr. Michael Shermer, who is the self-styled king of the skeptics.
He's in a little bit of legal trouble right now.
Oh, he is. And
I won't even throw gas on that fire, but you guys can Google up his issues. Mm-hmm.
Yes, and when you do, all I can say is Schadenfreude never felt so good. But when I knew Michael Shermer in 93 and 94, he was a very, very false friend. We would talk and I'd help him. I introduced him to the subject matter. I got him on the Phil Donahue show. And after maybe the third time of being stabbed in the back by this guy publicly, that was part of the whole passive thing of just, I'm not going to prevail. I'm simply not going to win in this thing. And just by win, I just mean being heard objectively. And then the active reason I left was at the same time I was having these feelings of just being very down on my chances of ever really making a difference. At the same time, the Jewish Defense League put out initially a $4,000 bounty on my head. The bounty started in 1994 at only $4,000. I think I'm worth a little bit more, right? I mean, my gosh, $4,000, even in 1994 dollars, still, it's not a lot of money. I mean, for a human life, good heavens. My skill alone at horror movie trivia, that alone should earn me more.
But
you know?
David, they're a Jewish organization. How much money do you think they're going to give away?
Well, that is a very good point, because that initial bounty did not do much. So they upped
the bounty. Not really a Jewish organization. They're a bunch of crazy racists. That's it.
Well, they're thugs. Yeah. No, they are thugs who believe
it. Both died in jail.
They're thugs who believe in squashing dissent. And I made this comment to someone on Facebook a few days ago, someone who hadn't heard of me since the old days and was glad to hear I was still alive. And I said, Irv Rubin and Earl Krugel, the two heads of the JDL who were implicated in a half dozen murders and bombings and firebombings, they're 6 feet under. And hey, I'm still here. I think it's not terribly cruel for me to take a small amount of, if not pleasure, at the very least, smiling a little bit at the irony that they worked so hard to try to get me killed, and here we are so many years later, and I get to still breathe in the sweet smell of the morning dew, and they don't. Now, I'm saying this, I'm tempting fate. I'm saying this because now someone's going to be like, well, now I'll kill him. I don't want anyone to try to kill me, and I'm not trying to make light of anyone's death. But when Irv Rubin, when that $4,000 bounty didn't work, he upped it to $25,000. I don't think he ever would have paid it, because I don't think he had it. I think his idea was, because by 1997, the internet had become something that more and more people were having, and that people understood what websites and .coms were. I think that by 97, when Irv Rubin upped the bounty to 25,000, he was just hoping some crazy guy would kill me and then try to claim the money. And Irv Rubin, who had always managed at that point to stay one step ahead of the law, Rubin would have been like, oh, that was a joke. We're not going to pay them. Oh, no, we're not going to pay the money. I really don't think he had 25 grand to blow on my death. He finally ran afoul of the law. He and Earl Krugel, his second in command, finally ran afoul of the law one time too many in December of 2001, a couple months after 9/11, when they were caught trying to blow up a mosque in Culver City and to kill a Lebanese American politician named Daryl Issa. This is how dumb Irv Rubin and his people were. Daryl Issa was a Christian, Lebanese Christian. They didn't even realize that just because you're Lebanese doesn't necessarily mean you're Muslim. And Daryl Issa is a Republican and a fairly strong supporter of Israel and quite the neocon, quite the staunch neocon. So Rubin and his guys were plotting against, I mean, number one, they were going to blow up a mosque in a trendy part of LA. And then they were going to kill a Lebanese American congressman who has many Israeli friends. It was as dumb a plan as imaginable. And they were caught before they could do any harm. Irv Rubin and Earl Krugel were both, Rubin went to prison, and I believe Krugel pled to a charge in order to avoid trial. Either way, both guys ended up dead. Irv Rubin either fell or was thrown from a top tier in the LA prison and landed on his head, and actually survived in a kind of brain dead capacity for maybe, I think, a couple of weeks before he passed. And Earl
How could
Krugel,
you tell the difference?
Yeah, Rubin was, he was an interesting man. He was the scariest looking Jew I'd ever known. If your image of Jews is Woody Allen and Mel Brooks and guys who were kind of short in stature and, hey, look at me being funny, Irv Rubin was like a man made out of granite. He was tall. He was frightening looking. He was muscular, and he had the kind of face that looked like you could not do any damage to it. You could punch it 100 times and he'd be fine. He was a very, very imposing man, especially to somebody like me. I'm only 5'6". I'm a small framed individual. And so when I have this 6'4" stone creature, golem in front of me, it's certainly very off-putting, and he beat me a couple times. I took the hits because the couple of times that he did punch me were all times where I had put myself in a situation where I didn't have proper security. And I'm just one of these guys who believes that if you're dumb like that, you put yourself in jeopardy. I don't believe in punching anyone. I don't think that there's no situation.
What's so ridiculous is this is all over your historical opinions, and organizations full of racists like his organization, or the ADL for that matter, they have all this esteem and praise. And when they're acting like crazy racists, and yet someone like yourself, who's just trying to revise history and get at the truth of the matters, you're accused of being racist. It's a lot like the Israeli state. They're the ones ethnically cleansing their neighbors and building Jewish-only houses and bulldozing down homes and things. But if you point that out, you're racist for not supporting their racism. Everything's backwards on that issue.
Yeah, and I actually initially, back in 1990, I tried to reason with Irv Rubin. I didn't know, none of the people I knew had email back then. I sent him a letter, and I tried to reason with him exactly on that point, that I'm not engaged in hate speech as it is defined by the politically correct and by the ADL and groups like that. I'm not hating anyone for anything that they believe in, or for who their mother was, or for what country they came from. My point was always the same. I'm just talking about history as it unfolded in certain particular areas, Poland in 1941 through 45, and Germany at the same period. And I'm citing documents and I'm citing testimony and I'm citing physical evidence. And if I'm wrong, the best way to prove that I'm wrong is to simply explain why I'm wrong. The very idea of telling a historian that they're wrong by yelling, "You anti-Semitic pig." Well, what does that prove? That's not an answer. That's not a claim. That's simply an epithet. If I'm mistaken,
it's like grabbing a megaphone and saying you're part of the New World Order, blah blah blah, and never letting anybody challenge you back or say anything. You've always been open and not been dogmatic. And I mean, I've seen you debate on talk shows, which I think was the best time you ever got over was when yourself and Mark Weber were on the Montel show. Because you had a neutral audience, but then later CBS edited that really horribly, and it made you look like you were saying things that you, of course, had never said. But they could get away with it back then because there wasn't an internet, and you couldn't just put the thing up on YouTube and punk them out. And that's how it was, and this is how it was, folks, before the internet.
It was very frustrating, Ryan, and there's a generation of young people today, and there will be more in the next generation who just, they're not going to know that feeling of helplessness when you were basically, if you were not going to be carried by the so-called mainstream media, or if the mainstream media was going to carry you and abuse your point of view and lie about it, well, all you could really do was type up a piece of paper and send out a newsletter, try to get a few people's addresses, and send out 15 or 20 or 25 little staple bound newsletters. It was not a way. And of course, that is paltry enough. And then on top of that, obviously, there was no way to like search it. Like, hey, I want to find out what newsletters there are about revisionism. Let me do a Google search. Well, there was no Google. If you didn't hear about it, it was almost impossible to find out about it. One example I'll give you: when I did a speaking gig at the University of Texas at Austin in 93, and I was there, I wasn't there necessarily of my own accord. I mean, I went willingly, but the University of Texas at Austin, their newspaper, the Daily Texan, was going to run an advertisement for one of my videos. This wasn't me doing it. This was a guy who was a fan of mine who enjoyed putting ads in newspapers for my videos. So it was a very simple ad. Basically, just said, buy this video, fascinating historical facts, done. Nothing about Jews. The word Jew wasn't mentioned in there. Even Israel wasn't mentioned in there. Nothing was mentioned in there. Just simple ad for a video. And the Daily Texan newspaper was going to publish the ad. And when word got out, there was a humongous explosion on campus of protests from Hillel and then off campus, the ADL and various other groups all descended on UT Austin to protest the ad. I was asked by the editorial board of the paper to come and defend the ad at a public hearing that was about to take place. And I figured, yeah, I'll fly to Austin, easy enough trip, and I'll do that. So I went to Austin for that very specific purpose. And before I had my chance to speak, one person after another person after another person got up and denounced me. None of these people had ever met me. None of them had ever seen my work. They just got up and said, this monster, this self-hating traitor, this monster must be destroyed. He must be stopped. And it was a nonstop cavalcade of people who knew nothing about me, who were getting up there and denouncing me. Now, the reason I brought this up about the mainstream media, the Associated Press in Texas covered that open meeting. They covered it because it was attended by maybe 300 or 400 people. I think I still have video of it someplace. And the AP covered it. When the AP ran the story written by their Southwestern bureau chief, Pauline Arriaga, I still remember her name because what she did was just not excusable. She claimed in her piece to be quoting the ad, the one that was being debated, the one for my film. And she said, David Cole, the author of the ad, claims that the Holocaust is a total fantasy myth, and it uses words that I never used, but she put them in quotes as though they were actual quotes from me. And I called her at the AP office and I said, where did these quotes come from? I don't say those kind of things. I never use those kind of terms because they're loaded terms. I don't say the Holocaust is a fantasy.
You have to define it, of course.
Yeah, exactly. You have to define it. And I said, so where did you get those quotes? And she said, I'll get back to you. And like 2 days later, she faxed me on her AP letterhead saying, oh, so sorry. Those quotes came from faulty background information. In other words, they were phony. And the reason she was willing to admit that on the letterhead of her own AP stationery is because back then I was helpless. What am I going to do? Oh, put it online. Well, this is 1992. Send it around to an email list. All that stuff that we have now was not available. So I basically had to just suck it up and deal with it, which is why when I get the chance to mention Pauline Arriaga and some of the other people who did this 20 years ago, I'm happy to mention their names because they certainly never had to answer for what they did back then. They're in my book, and a couple of them, interestingly enough, Ryan, a couple of them have apologized. Now, 20 years later, here's a quick example of a guy who apologized. The guy, the editor of the Detroit Jewish News, who compared me to Hitler and Hussein and Arafat in 1994, he went on to edit a Baltimore Jewish newspaper, and he ended up becoming the target of Jewish harassment and hatred because while this guy, and he's Jewish himself, while this guy was editing the Baltimore paper, he ran a very well-written series of pieces about a very popular local Baltimore synagogue where child molestations were taking place. And he ran a very honest series of articles about this synagogue and how it's not just that there was molestations going on, but how a lot of the members of the synagogue were covering up for the rabbis and cantors who were doing the molestations. So here you had the guy, this editor, who called me Hitler and Saddam Hussein, and now here he is later on writing a very fair and honest piece about molestations in a synagogue, and he gets death threats, and he gets vandalism, and he gets called Hitler, and he gets called the worst names in the book. So when I contacted him last year about my book, I straight out asked him, I said, I do you have any more... Any possible sympathy for my situation and what you said about me unjustifiably now that you have been the recipient of unjustified hatred? And he was very honest. He said, yes. He said, yeah, I'm sorry. I'm sorry about that whole calling you Hitler thing. I was wrong. Time and experience had taught this man a lesson about what it means when you throw those kind of terms around. Sometimes this happens to all of us at some point. Sometimes we just have to be the recipient of something to really understand the wrong we've done to someone else.
Well, there's such a sense of tribalism attached to it. Anything that any individual within the group does that's bad, if you point that out, some people take that as an attack on the collective and freak out. Oh, you hate the Jews or the whatevers, whatever group they associate themselves with. I've always found it funny that people still make a point to introduce you as a Jewish revisionist instead of just a revisionist. And I know why, because the topic's about the Holocaust, and it's kind of to say, well, look, I'm Jewish, and which sort of does help defend you from, because if you weren't Jewish, people would call you a Nazi even quicker, perhaps. But it's weird to me that people still label others for their occupation. It's like, she's an engineer and a woman or something. It just sounds ridiculous to me.
Yeah, that would exactly. That would happen a lot during the time that I was business partners with a talk radio host named Larry Elder, who's black and who's one of the highest rated hosts on KABC radio. And people would say, oh, David's working with black talk radio host Larry Elder. I'm like, what the hell does that matter to anything? But what's a black talk radio host? And when I did the Phil Donahue show, my status as having not been bar mitzvahed became incredibly important to him. If you watch that video on YouTube, and a lot of people have uploaded it, there's a good 7 or 8 minute period where he and I just go back and forth over the bar mitzvah thing, because I answer the question, I have not been bar mitzvahed, and he keeps hammering away at me, why were you not bar mitzvahed?
Because I'm an atheist, you ass. Why would I be?
And I couldn't get him off the topic. And it was very, if I were as old now as I was 20 years ago, I would have seen more of the humor in it. But I got very frustrated as a young man, as a very young man back then. I got really frustrated with the fact that, dude, I'm on your show. You flew me out to New York and you're asking me BS questions about whether I'm bar mitzvahed that have nothing to do with my historical work. But he wouldn't let up on it because he didn't have any answers for the historical point. So he just wanted to make the whole episode about me and whether or not I'm a good Jew or not. And this is what's fascinating, Ryan, is here's a man, a very leftist Catholic, who is often accused of being a bad Catholic. He gets that flack because of his support for unfettered abortion rights and other things. So Catholics say that Phil Donahue's a bad Catholic. And he says, how can you say that? That's an insult. Don't say that. But then with me, he does that same thing, calling me a bad Jew and a Jew not worthy of being a Jew. And as I said, we spent like 7 or 8 minutes just going around and around on that completely pointless line of question.
Yeah, it was ridiculous. But I think he was just trying to avoid having to talk about the history because he was getting owned on those points. And so he just changed the subject because he's the host and that's what he does every day. And he knew how to do that.
Yeah, one of the things for your listeners, if they watch that show on YouTube, and you can just find it by looking for David Cole and Donahue, as I said, there's a bunch of people who have uploaded it. But one of the funny things is, at the end of the second commercial break, Donahue has been completely owned on the historical part. I called him on stuff left and right, and he was getting angrier and angrier. And so at the end of the second segment, as they're fading.
They had a film of Dachau, which doesn't have gas chambers, and they were claiming there are gas chambers.
And then Dachau tries, and they show the Dachau, and Donahue tries to say, wait, was that footage of Dachau? I don't know if that was footage of Dachau. And I say something like, dude, you're showing this on your program, and you don't know what you're showing? And he gets really, really flustered. And what you see as they're fading to commercial, because the audio is gone, they're just playing the bumper music. But as they're fading to commercial, you see Donahue bolt up from his chair and rip his mic off his tie and throw it on the floor and point at me. Now, that's what you can see. You can't hear what's being said because of the bumper music. But what happened was after his ownage, at that moment, he, as they were going to commercial, he bolts up, rips off his mic, points at me, and calls me the Antichrist. And he's not done yet, because then he goes backstage and starts yelling like a banshee at his producer, a fellow named Brad Hurtado, who now works on True TV, a very nice fellow. And he starts reaming his producer for that Dachau footage. Why would you give me, you gave me that footage. You didn't tell me that was Dachau, and I'm supposed to, how am I supposed to know when you don't tell me? Donahue was so completely humiliated at that moment. And I felt bad for his producer because the producer had given Donahue all of the notes, but Donahue had only cared about reading the stuff about my bar mitzvah. He didn't read the other stuff. He was caught with his pants down, but like any coward, he blames the people around him instead of himself.
Yeah, of course. Well, I mean, but that's how it was back then. You could get on a live show, perhaps, and they stacked the deck of that show. The callers and everything was ridiculous. And then there's the Montel Williams show. But other than that, had it not been for those events, I don't think anybody outside your state would have really known who you were or been able to read or reach you or been able to search for you. Because back in the early 90s and late 80s, there just wasn't a way to do that. A good example I use is the contrast between the first Gulf War in Iraq and the second Gulf War in Iraq. Before the second war, you saw millions of people protesting around the entire world before the war even started. Before the first Gulf War, you had the whole babies on incubators stuff, and yeah, everybody attacked and everybody was pro-war on nearly uniformly. And yet, if you go back now as a revisionist and say, you know that they lied about the babies on incubators, no one's going to accuse you of hating Kuwaitis, and no one's going to accuse you of supporting Saddam Hussein. They would just admit that, yes, that was a Hilton Knowlton-coached PR stunt to generate a war, which is what it was. But there isn't the same kind of attachment to that war as World War II, because World War II is the war that justifies all future wars. Even today, Putin's the new Hitler. There's always a new Hitler, and that's always the go-to boogeyman to justify aggression. And so if you undermine World War II, then you undermine warfare in general, because that is their best weapon.
You're 100% right about that, Ryan. It reminds me of a cartoon, one of the Doonesbury cartoons by Gary Trudeau during the second Iraq war. And of course, Gary Trudeau is a very left-leaning Democratic Party associated fellow, and he follows the party line and he follows the standard line that's both Republican and Democrat about World War II being the good war and therefore the justification of other wars. And Trudeau, in this cartoon, it was one of the color cartoons that appears in the Sunday Times, and his character, Mike Doonesbury, the guy who's basically his spokesman in the cartoon, the sounding board for his own ideas, Doonesbury is talking about how dare Bush employ torture, because in World War II we defeated the Nazis and the Japanese and never employed torture or inhumane means. I wrote to Trudeau and I asked if I could wager with him for charity. I said, I'll wager $5,000. And you pick a couple of objective judges and we wager whether or not torture and inhumane means were used by the Western allies during World War II. I said, not even counting the Soviet allies, just the Western allies. He's in a kind of daze that happens when you grow up around this propaganda. The World War II, nobody was tortured, only the bad guys lost. Any territory that was seized was justifiably seized. Of course, France deserved Alsace-Lorraine. Of course it did. There's no sense of going back and examining what happened during that war and the horrific levels of propaganda that brought it about, and then how the propaganda simply became more important as the decades went on. There's always propaganda in war. There's never been a war without propaganda. But what makes World War II even more unique, as you alluded to earlier, because it is used as a justification for other wars, because it's known as the good war, the war that had to happen, the propaganda has simply grown in importance And anyone who tries to bring a little bit of light and sorting of the fiction from the nonfiction, they're pilloried. They're called every name in the book: Nazi sympathizer, in my case, self-hating Jew, Jewish traitor, whatever name. Anything so that people are not encouraged to think rationally about that dark side of that war. Because if we can say that the good war had that dark side to it, well, then what about the other wars?
Is so important. It's a central theme in World War II, because initially the war kicked off for the Allied powers because Poland was being occupied. Well, after the war, Poland was still being occupied just by the Soviets instead of the Germans. And so they had to change the reason for the war from the occupation of Poland and the other territories to saving the Jews from the Holocaust. They also need it because without that, they are guilty of all the same crimes that the Japanese and the Germans did themselves. And there's nothing they can point to, killing civilians, torturing, etc. They did all of the above, starve people to death, everything. The only thing differentiating themselves from the Nazis is the story of the Holocaust. And I think that's why it's so vital, because without that, World War II just becomes a giant stage of imperial colonial powers killing each other over nothing.
Exactly. And I think it was around the time that Saving Private Ryan came out in the theaters that I recall reading a review that was explaining why the Nazis were terrorists, but the British and Americans weren't during that war. And they said, well, the Nazis bombed England to terrorize people, whereas the British and Americans bombed Germany just in self-defense. Now there's no way that is supportable by the facts, but it's a prevalent myth. But if you compare the sheer numbers of dead from the bombing campaigns in Dresden and Hamburg compared to Coventry, for example, which is one of the bombing campaigns the British like to point to, we're talking about an incredibly disproportional figure. Part of what the Western Allies did in the bombing campaign against Germany was to bomb densely populated civilian areas. Because that did several things. It accomplished several war goals. It destroyed the morale of the German people. It redirected forces from the front to have to come into the interior to defend their cities. And it disrupted transportation and the ability to get things back and forth from the front. Now, in saying this, I want to make clear, I'm not supporting any of these guys. Like you said, colonialist powers, imperial powers fighting each other. The innocent victims on all sides were innocent. A 12-year-old German girl burned.
That is how the war should be viewed, as as governments slaughtering people and civilians getting killed, rather than this government's good and this government was bad. Yeah. That's how it's always painted in our government schools. But actually, war is just a senseless act of mass murder to solve problems that, I mean, adults should not be murdering each other to try and resolve issues over land, resources, etc. But if people understood that government is just a manager for corporate conglomerates and has nothing to do with making laws or building the roads or whatever, it's government that's the problem. And that's we're always the victims of war, or the civilians. And the main cause of death is starvation, which is what I'm leading into, is getting into these camps, why everybody was so skinny and dying. If the public is dying on the outside, of course prisoners are going to be dying on the inside. And the responsibility is because of the war and because of the bombings, because of whoever's winning. Not that the Germans wouldn't have done the same had they had the better military. Everyone was evil in the government.
Yeah. And the 12-year-old girl burned alive in Hamburg, and the 12-year-old girl bombed in Poland, and the 12-year-old girl bombed in Coventry, they were all equally innocent. They all were equally not responsible for this explosion of violence and cruelty on the part of those governments. So that is such an important point for people to keep in mind when they talk about World War II. It's appalling how the war has become known as the Great War. And it's more appalling when you realize that part of how this whole good war myth was created is because of these images of the starving people, the sick people in the labor camps at the very end of the war. The Allies,
they could have shown the same photos in Bengal, the Congo, or many other places at the exact yeah. same time period where people were starving to death.
And an interesting thing, just to there anyone who has a good familiarity with revisionism understands that the figure 6 million was used for other Jewish losses and other things before the end of World War II. 6 million was kind of a figure of choice for a lot of Zionist groups and propagandists.
Well, it's a prophetic type of number.
Yeah.
As yeah. you see it again and again mm-hmm. during World War I and prior to World War II and prior to the beginning of the camps, even during World War II, but before, let's say, conservatively 41, they already had that 6 million figure yeah. everywhere.
Yeah, and exactly. And by that same token, the images of the emaciated dead bodies in a pile was used on the cover of, I believe it was Life magazine. Now, I never like to say for certain whether it was Life or another popular magazine at that time. This is something
that was Life because that ended up being owned by C.D. Jackson, who worked in the psych mm-hmm. war department.
And that was years before the actual footage of those sick and dying people. In other words, that footage of the emaciated bodies was already kind of decided upon. Now, one of the things that the Western Allies did, and we know this because you can go to the National Archives and look up the raw Army Signal Corps footage, the raw footage, not the stuff that was shown in the newsreels, not the stuff that was edited down to a tight 60 seconds. A lot of what the Army did when they came upon these labor camps. Now, at Bergen-Belsen, there was definitely a lot of death and misery. Bergen-Belsen was overcrowded. I believe I talked a bit about Bergen-Belsen on your show the first time I was on. Bergen-Belsen was definitely a place of horrific misery at the very end of the war. But the U.S. Army did a few other things at other camps. One of the things that they would do, there is a difference between a homicidal mass grave and a simple cemetery that's clearly marked. In other words, there's a difference between murdering 3,000 people and burying them under the earth and not telling anyone they're there, or putting gravestones up for everyone who dies and saying, here lies Bob and here lies Tom. The U.S. Army would go into labor camps and dig up clearly marked cemeteries, not mass graves, not things that anyone was trying to hide, but cemeteries that had headstones, identification for the people who were buried there. And they would dig them up and create piles of bodies. And then say, you'd have the breathless narrator in the newsreel. Here you'll see at the Oranienburg camp, the mass grave where 200 people were killed in unmarked graves. But you see the raw footage, and it was simply a cemetery.
Sometimes they're piled on top of each other. You would see piles of bodies, yeah. as if yeah. really they put piles of bodies there to just rot, which would cause disease and infect themselves, like seriously. But that's what they did. But let me play the slippery slope argument, and you can knock this
sure.
down. I'm not trying to make a straw man. This is a serious argument that the counter forces try to do. They'll say, and I'm just playing devil's advocate, let's say. They'll say, okay, well, all right, we know that wartime rumors were seized upon and became part of war propaganda, such as the nonsense about Jewish soap and lampshades, shrunken heads, human pelvis ashtrays, things we talked about last time. And the U.S. Psych War Department went in so far as to hire Hollywood directors like Billy Wilder, as I mentioned earlier, and they came and they filmed props on a stage. They brought in the whole city. The city of Weimar was marched into Buchenwald, for example, and they were shown fake props of the
yeah.
the lampshades and the rest of it as part of their denazification. So their cities have been bombed. You know, people they knew were dead. So the Allies really needed something theatrical in its level of evil to top that. And so these are all known and admitted lies. But to say, okay, well, all of that stuff is false, and it's, and the more over the top nonsense like the electric floors and the eagles and bears,
the gas fans at the Museum of Tolerance.
Yeah.
But I mean, that's obviously false. But just because of that and those being ridiculous lies doesn't mean gas chambers weren't there. That's kind of throwing the baby out with the bathwater. Or the 6 million figure and up is wrong. You're throwing the baby out with the bathwater. Why, if it doesn't hinge on those things, why are you saying there weren't gas chambers or that the 6 million figure is off the mark?
Right. And that's an important point to bring up, because that is a fairly standard point that the other side will bring up. And my response is,
oh, cliffhanger. Too bad. That's just landed on the 1 hour mark. That's how it goes. Don't go anywhere, folks. We have another hour to continue with this interview with Mr. David Cole Stein. Do consider buying his book below, Republican Party Animals. I also have a book that's out called The Separation of Business and State, which can be found on the link below, too. That's an ebook. It's only $4.99. Please consider purchasing it, not only for the information, but also as a type of donation to myself and programs like these, because that is how we finance them. This is the only commercial, and that's how we keep them going, so that I can have fine guests like Mr. Cole and all my other guests.